History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've learned is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions, and perhaps more importantly, invest enough time to patiently listen as memories from long ago start to bubble back up to the surface. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The newly minted centenarian I have the privilege of introducing you to this weekend is actually someone that longtime listeners to this program have heard before. Well, you haven't heard his story, and you haven't even heard his voice, but you have heard his musical talents. Every once in a while on Hometown Heroes, you might hear a little interlude of one of the service hymns, like this one I'm pretty sure you're going to recognize. So, whether it's Anchors Away or the tunes for other branches of service, when you hear one of those on Hometown Heroes, it's from a recording of the Sounds of Freedom Band, an amazing group of dedicated volunteers who've been performing around Central California and beyond for nearly 40 years. There's one baritone player who has been with the band from the beginning, and he just celebrated his 100th birthday this week. Bob Clark has been a teacher, administrator, and the best dad in the world, according to his daughter Sherry, who organized a big celebration for his centennial. You can hear Bob's musical talent for yourself at the Sounds of Freedom's next concert, March 13th, in Clovis, California. But we get to hear from this 100-year-old himself about how he embarked on this musical journey that he's still enjoying today. Bob grew up in the raisin capital of the world, Selma, California.
My mother was a piano teacher, so I started piano when I was about 5 years old. But I wanted to march, and you don't do very much marching with pianos. So when I got into the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, they didn't call it a junior high, but they had an orchestra. So I bought a new violin. It cost me all of $13. And played violin there for 3 years under Harvey Whistler. But there was still no marching. And when I got to high school, 9th grade, only we didn't call it 9th, it was freshman.
Sure.
I signed up for band, and it took me, I think, about 9 weeks to get into the regular band. So I could read music. All I had to do was get the fingering going.
So you've been playing the baritone since high school?
Yes.
So more than 80 years.
Oh, I don't know. Who's counting?
Did you ever stop playing? Did you ever have a break where you weren't playing the horn?
Just a little period during World War II. But I was in Navy, and I was in the band aboard ship. I played baritone there. I also played slide trombone for the dance band.
Beautiful.
Aboard ship.
And I want to talk to you about that. But can you tell me why you're still playing your baritone at age 100? Why do you still do it?
Opportunity to express oneself.
Well, you mentioned World War II, but let's talk about before that. So those, when you talked about saving up $13 to get a violin,
yes,
that's during the Great Depression. That was a lot of money.
Yes, it was.
What do you remember about your hometown, Selma, during those Depression years? What was it like?
Well, my parents were divorced, and my mother was teaching private piano lessons in Selma. So she was supporting her mother, my brother, her older boy, and me. and herself. On top of that, she was able to buy a 1928 Ford business coupe. It wasn't brand new, but it was the 1928 first Model A year.
Do you remember, did you have a dream, an ambition? Some boys say, hey, when I grow up, here's what I want to do. Did you have something like that?
I wanted to be a doctor.
Yeah?
That's interesting here. My mother wanted to be a nurse. Her father said, no, you're going to be a piano teacher. Sent her to the Oberlin Conservatory of Music back in Ohio.
Yeah.
And she came back to Selma and taught private lessons. I forgot where I'm going with this.
Well, I asked you what you wanted to be, and you said you wanted to be a doctor.
Oh, yes. And I wanted to be a doctor, and it just wasn't in the lineup for me to do that. We have a grandson that wanted to be a doctor, and he's a doctor.
Good for him.
Yeah, he's down at a big clinic down in Southern California. He's doing very well.
Glad to hear it. So you graduated high school, 1938.
Right.
What did you do after that?
I went to Reedley College.
Uh-huh.
It was Reedley Junior College at that time. How old was I? I think it must have been about 16. Mm. Yeah, I was 16 when I graduated from high school. So I was 18 when I graduated from junior college. War was looking kind of seriously. So I kept on to college, tried to get as much as I could. I stayed out for one semester, though, between graduating from Reedley College and getting into Fresno State. And I was no longer a pre-med major. That is just an impossibility for me. So I took a music major at Fresno State. And I was at Fresno State for a year.
So you were at Fresno State when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that? Do you remember how you found out? How you got that news?
How I got Pearl Harbor?
Yeah.
I listened to radio.
Do you remember what you were doing that day?
I was working in the Chevrolet garage in Selma. When I started working on cars, I was polishing. I just love to polish a car, especially one that looks real grungy and like it practically new.
Yeah.
You know. And I was working in the Allen Chevrolet garage. John Allen was the owner of that. And he and my mother had been in Selma High School at about that time. And so he knew our family, and we knew about his. I was working, and we did things at the garage on Sunday, and I was working there with Pleistrup, with his name, Lee Pleistrup, was the shop foreman, and we were working on stuff. I was doing some work on new cars. They had me polish new cars, make them look a little sharper. Uh-huh. And I heard this broadcast. I thought, things are going to change.
How did they change? What did you notice?
Well, I was thinking about eventually having to put on a uniform, so I wanted to go to college as long as I could before going into the service. So that's what I did. And I enlisted in Naval Intelligence. And I was eventually sent to Mare Island. There was a branch intelligence office there. And I still lived at home and hitchhiked. We lived in, little kind of a weird thing. We lived in Oakland. We had a Piedmont phone number and a Berkeley address. But when things got a little more serious as the time passed with the war, the Navy decided they would send me to boot camp. I had been in for 6 months, never had boot camp because it's all intelligent stuff.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you, before you tell me any more, I'm just thinking about what else you shared. Selma High School, Reedley College, Fresno State. Did you have any friends or acquaintances who were Japanese American?
Oh, yes. Yes. Uh-huh. Wataru Takeshita. I could go on and name him. Wataru and I and another couple of guys kind of went together before the Pearl Harbor thing happened. So we were more academically inclined, especially Wataru, who is a very able student.
Was it hard for you to see how they were treated after Pearl Harbor?
Yeah.
What happened to him?
He was I've forgotten what they called it, but it was a settlement.
Sometimes they call them relocation centers.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Or internment camps.
Yeah.
So he got sent away from his home.
Right.
Was that puzzling for you, or is that just...
Yeah, that was what he paid to his country, what they asked him to do. They just put him in the relocation center.
Bob's friend Wataru Takeshita would spend 3 years behind barbed wire at the Gila River internment camp in Arizona, where he became editor of the camp newspaper and also taught English to those who didn't speak it as well as he did. Later, Takeshita joined the Army, ended up teaching as part of the Army Specialized Training Program at the University of Minnesota before heading overseas as an interpreter in Japan. Takeshita ended up earning bachelor's and master's degrees from Stanford and enjoying a long journalism career with the San Rafael Independent Journal. He was also a member of the Screen Actors Guild and had small roles in several movies, including the 1987 thriller The Principal, starring Jim Belushi and Lou Gossett Jr. If you watch that film, you'll find Bob's friend Wataru portraying a maintenance man. Wat Takeshita passed away in 2016 at the age of 95. But now let's get back to Bob's story.
So you said you enlist in the Navy. After 6 months with intelligence, they sent you to boot camp. But what did you do for those first 6 months? What kinds of things did they have you doing in naval intelligence?
Filing reports on individuals, on organizations, and we had those reports that had to be filed, and so... That's what we did for intelligence.
So then they send you to boot camp. What was that like?
I think I was actually in boot camp for a week.
That's it?
Yeah.
What happened?
There were several of us in this situation. Since we'd already been in, say, for 6 months, and we all knew how to salute, and we, all of this background... Gave us the background stuff. And then some guys went to some kind of a skill school.
Sure.
I didn't go to any school. I worked with the filing and so on. And then all of a sudden, I was sent to Pearl Harbor on a battleship for transportation. On the way, I go over, hey, can I play baritone in your ship's band? Oh, it tickled to death to have me play it. So that was the USS New Mexico.
Well, the New Mexico went through some serious stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to hear about it when we come back. 100-year-old Bob Clark of Clovis, California is our guest today. The instrument he was playing aboard the USS New Mexico, the euphonium, comes from the Greek for good sounding. And if you live in Central California and want to hear the sweet, smooth, low brass sounds of that euphonium or baritone horn, as only this centenarian can play it, check out Bob and the Sounds of Freedom Band in their next free concert. That's going to be held March 13th at 2 p.m. at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building. I have that information for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find photos of Bob and a short video of his band saluting him with happy birthday this past week. That's on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page as well. And hey, we're going to be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing, close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 100-year-old Bob Clark of Clovis, California, still playing his baritone horn whenever he has the chance, whether it's with the all-stars of the Sounds of Freedom Band or simply using those musical talents to bless his fellow residents of Carmel Village in Clovis. If you're from Central California, he may have been your teacher once upon a time at Edison High School in Fresno, or your counselor at Reedley College, where he himself had been a student before World War II. We heard how the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor interrupted Bob's studies at Fresno State, how he enlisted in the Navy, and after 6 months in intelligence, was sent to boot camp. When we left off, he had gotten aboard the battleship USS New Mexico, where his lifelong love of music actually rerouted his military destiny.
I was assigned to the band's director.
Uh-huh.
Just because he requested it on an inspection. Here we are. I'm wearing my seaman stuff. And the captain stopped right in front of me. He says, "What's this?" The bandmaster said, "Just transferred aboard, sir. Can he play?" "Yes, sir." "Give him his right." That's how I made a third-class musician's right.
So if I'm understanding this right, you had not been actually assigned to the New Mexico. You were just going to be transported on it.
Yes.
But you talked your way into the band.
Yes.
So then you were assigned to the ship.
Yes.
That's a pretty unique story.
Yeah, that's the way it worked. And eventually I made second class.
Uh-huh.
But you have to be in a particular grade before you can go to the next higher. You have to,
right.
So I made it for the third to, I think it was 6 weeks or something like that. I had to be in, I don't remember the times, but that's the idea. And then had to be in for 9 to be in second class to make first class. And I wasn't on that ship long enough. We took on a kamikaze Japanese plane.
Yeah. Where were you and how did you experience it?
Oh, well, we were at battle stations. And the musicians aboard that ship were assigned to dressing station at first aid. And so we were immediately involved when the plane hit. I was talking to the senior medical officer on the intercom, and then I heard bang. I never heard a bang like that before.
Wow.
So I said, "Sir, I believe we've been hit." What? I said, "I believe we've been hit, sir." He said, "Just a minute." And about half a minute, he came back, "Stand by to receive casualties." So we had been hit, and I knew about it. But I don't know who else recognized the sound.
Well, I do know at least one person who did, because he's told us about it here on Hometown Heroes. Grant Erickson actually grew up not far from Bob in Central California. Let's hear his memories from the USS New Mexico, starting just before Bob Clark talked or musically played his way onto the crew.
at Bremerton, we took on a new captain, Captain Fleming. No more Zacharias. He was now gone. We stayed in contact with him, however. But Captain Fleming was a wonderful, wonderful fellow, kind of soft-spoken guy, and gave us a nice talk as we left Bremerton and said that we'll soon be in the thick of battle again, which we were. And so it wasn't too long before we were out there in suicide country.
Well, and that's my question. So all this time you've been out there, mm-hmm. had you ever heard of this phenomenon of a plane
really.
That would try to crash into your ship?
Not really, no.
So when you get back out there and now the first weeks of 1945, you got your first taste of this kamikaze thing.
Yeah, that's right.
And you saw it happen to other ships before your own?
Oh, yeah. Actually, in the Philippines, we were supposed to cover for a landing on Luzon, which is on the eastern area of Philippines. We were supposed to send many, many, many projectiles, you know what I mean, but we couldn't because we were too involved in fighting the aircraft. I think it was the California was shot, it was hit by a suicide plane before our ship. Actually, every major ship on that day that we were hit was hit at least once by a suicide plane. And the problem was that our aircraft covering couldn't really take off from Tinian because it had been raining so bad. The weather was terrible. And so we had no air cover. So we just had to fight it on our own.
So you're up there on the bridge?
I'm on the bridge.
And what can you see?
Well, I see planes.
Planes everywhere.
Planes kind of everywhere, yeah. And we shot at a lot of them, too, you know what I mean? And
but they're all Japanese.
Yeah, right.
So the only defense you have is the guns on these ships.
Yeah.
So but a couple days before you get hit, an escort carrier near you, the Omani Bay, gets hit.
Yeah, right.
And you guys took on those survivors.
Took on the survivors, yeah, right.
So it's kind of building toward, this is happening to everybody else.
Yeah.
When's it going to happen to us?
Yeah.
It was a couple days later that it did.
Yeah, right.
So what happened at noon on January 6th of
45? Well, a plane came in from up above, and it had been hit, but it was coming, so it had to land somewhere.
Yeah.
It was a Zeke, a Zero, I think called. And carrying a 500-pound bomb, and it landed on the port wing of the navigation bridge.
And that's where you were?
That's where I was. I was just inside of the bridge.
Yep.
And the captain was standing at the entrance to the bridge on that port side looking outward, and he was blown to the bulkhead inside of the bridge in kind of a seated position against the wall, the bulkhead, we call it the wall. I remember quite vividly how it was. There was a young seaman who was also blown toward him right next to the captain. And I recall the captain putting his arm, the boy tried to get up, and the captain putting his arm on the shoulder of the boy, and he said, very weakly said, "Son, stay right where you are." And I recall that those were his last words. Medics came up right away, and they gave him a shot, but he was gone. I knew he was gone. The officer of the deck under whom I was serving, Lieutenant Sobel, was not injured that badly. He took shrapnel in his ankle and maybe a few other places, but he was injured, I've always felt, more psychologically than any other way. He went down to sick bay. He was taken down to sick bay, I guess, with some others. In addition to the captain who was killed, we lost a gunnery officer, and William Chickering, who was a Time War correspondent, was killed. An officer of the British Navy and one from the British Army who were observation guys that were aboard our ship, they were killed. It was just pandemonium. It was pretty tough. And steering, there are about four or five places on the battleship from which it can be steered. So the helmsman was injured on the bridge. So steering control was taken over down in the conning tower, which was below the bridge, and the navigator of the ship took over the control of the ship temporarily until everything could be worked out on the bridge. And eventually, the executive officer came up to the bridge and was now the new captain. He was a commander, but he was elevated to the rank of captain almost immediately.
Sure.
And became the new captain.
And you became the new officer of the deck.
And I became the new officer of the deck. It's kind of interesting because you have to serve your duty as a junior officer of the deck for 8 months, I think, prior to being elevated. But anyway, he elevated me right away to senior officer of the deck. And so for the next 4 or 5 days, when we were underway doing other things, bombarding and so forth, and so covering landing, it was just the captain and me on the bridge. The new captain had not too much experience on his own. He was an older man, of course. It was really something. At one point, we were to get into a column movement with, I think, 8 ships in the column, and we were to be number 8 or something like that. And it was time for us to make the move to get where we were supposed to be getting. And I said to the captain, isn't it time that we're making the move to the helm? Because on a battleship, you have to gauge when you make a move to turn at the position of the wake in front of you. So, that, you know, I mean, it's just kind of difficult to explain. But anyway, he just said, it's your call. And he was just testing me. Anyway, I breathed a little prayer, I guess, and made the call to the helmsman. I thought it'd make it, and turned out perfectly where we were supposed to be. It was a miracle, really. I mean, kind of fortunate that we ended up where we did.
Because if you don't get that timing right, you could collide with another ship.
It could be,
Or mess up a big domino effect.
Right.
So you're 23 years old and you're making those kind of calls. But I want to take you back to those moments, because you have some papers here from the National Archives. These are the official records of the ship of that day. And every single one of those descriptions is signed by G.A. Erickson. That's you. And you told us about what happened to the captain. He's killed by the concussion of this explosion, blown back against the bulkhead.
Yep.
The other sailor who's right there next to him, who he's trying to console or tell him, stay where you are. And I'm sure some people are listening and say, well, what about you? What happened to you? You're in the same room. It's the same explosion.
Yep.
How are you just fine and right here? What happened there?
I had just a little trickle of blood coming from top of my ear. A piece of Kleenex took care of it. You know what I mean? I just wasn't injured.
But how far are you from the captain?
About 6 feet.
You're 6 feet away.
About 6 feet.
Yeah. He's killed.
Yeah.
You're okay.
Just, you know, one of those things.
How do you explain that? I mean, is it? I don't want to make too much of it, but it almost sounds like it's a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego or Daniel in the lion's den going on here. How in the world does it work that way?
Well, I don't know. It's just one of those things. I was blessed. I guess I had other fish to fry.
Because that explosion clearly could have knocked you off your feet, too, if it knocked the captain off his feet.
Yeah.
Just the angle of the blast or something?
Probably.
Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, I've thought about it a few times,
It is pretty remarkable, don't you think?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And then all of a sudden you have all this responsibility. You know, maybe this would be interesting for people and educational for them too. There was something that happened on the ship not long after that where you guys honored those who died that day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Can you paint a picture of that for us? What's that like? What it looks like and maybe more importantly, what it feels like to be a part of that?
We had a regular memorial service later, but that night, about midnight, it was a very moving experience. All the those killed were flag-draped and then buried at sea. That was really quite an experience. We had a chaplain aboard ship who participated in that. I don't know, it was just a very touching experience. I mean, it's one of those things that happened. And
that includes that captain who was 6 feet away from you. His
his
coffin is draped with the flag and
pushed
out into the sea.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And as you're watching that happen, in my mind, that's where it would sink in. Why isn't that? Why am I not in one of those coffins?
Yeah. Well, I never have a thought about it.
And I get the sense that's still, just talking about it right now, kind of takes you back to that moment. You feel those same emotions?
I do. I've always said in my total experience in life, growing up and so forth, there was a bit of scripture that always came to me. The Apostle Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. I have thought about that many times, you know, in the service and at other times, even since.
Philippians 4:13. Yep.
Yeah.
And I guess the implication there is you never know what you're going to face.
No, that's true.
But if you have that as your baseline or your foundation, that whatever it is,
right,
you'll get through it.
Right.
And you did get through it.
Yeah.
And there were some more. I'm looking here at a story you tell about two torpedo wakes, and somehow
yes,
you're bracketed in by both of them, but they both missed you?
Yes. Well, actually, when we left the Philippines going east, we were going through Surigao Straits. The Indianapolis cruiser was behind us, immediately behind us, probably 1,000 yards, something like that. The lookouts sighted a torpedo wake on the right. And the captain, Captain Warren, was standing on the starboard side of the ship from the bridge, took note of that. And so he started to give an order to the helmsman to dodge this torpedo. And I was on the left wing looking out and thought, there's a torpedo wake coming in from the left side. So I started to give an order to the helmsman. The helmsman about went crazy because he didn't know whose order he was supposed to take, you know.
Yeah.
And so I remember Captain Warren say, you take every order you're given, just like that. You know, I could hear him say that. After this was all over, the captain came in and he said, you know, that was so close, I could have hit it with a spud. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, didn't you see that? And and I said, no, I was on the other side, dodging a torpedo coming in from the other side. And he was sort of flabbergasted. And the Indianapolis took a picture of that.
The picture shows your ship, the New Mexico,
yes,
with a torpedo wake on each side,
yes,
of it.
Right.
So the whole time the captain's saying, turn,
yes,
this way to get,
yes,
out of the way of this one.
Yes.
You're on the other side saying,
yes,
no, turn this way to get out of the,
yes,
way of that.
Yeah, it was a sort of a zigzag kind of a thing, yeah.
And somehow miraculously?
Miraculously, yeah.
They both miss you.
Yeah.
With each story, it seems like you're beating even more odds.
In a battleship, you have a lot more steel, you know, than if you were a cruiser or, you know, or a destroyer. It would have done a lot more damage.
Mm-hmm.
Not as much to a battleship, maybe, as it would be like to a cruiser.
But it would have done enough.
It would have done enough,
and
yeah,
then you would see enough after that. And you mentioned the Indianapolis, of course, it famously was,
yes,
sunk by Japanese torpedoes after delivering the elements of the atomic bomb to,
right,
Tinian. And that's where all the shark attacks came in. We've heard from survivors of that ship on this program, but we're talking to someone from the USS New Mexico, Grant Erickson. And you haven't even gotten to Okinawa yet. And that's,
no,
where it got crazy.
Really crazy. Weeks and weeks of...
Just nonstop kamikazes?
Almost, yeah.
How do you face that? It
gets kind of repetitious after a while.
Yeah.
You know, we had an interesting happening there in Okinawa. The Indianapolis, about 3 weeks, I guess it was, before we were hit, the second time with a suicide plane, it was hit by a suicide plane, and it did a lot of damage. And about 4 days after it was hit, Admiral Spruance, who was aboard the Indianapolis, came aboard our ship with some of his flag yeomen and so forth. So they were aboard our ship. At one time, the LSTs were making smoke screen to envelop all of us in smoke because there were a lot of suicide planes, and also we heard there were suicide boats also doing,
yeah,
damage. So they were making smoke. Our call name was Ironsides. I can remember the captain, since we weren't enveloped in smoke, wondering why we weren't, you know. He wanted to protect the Admiral and everybody else. So he sent his gunnery officer in a motor whale boat off to try to get to the ship that was doing this smoke screening. And shortly after the whale boat left the ship, the smoke just poured in. And actually, the whale boat kind of got lost.
I bet.
And it couldn't figure out how to get back. And I remember we had to ring the ship's bell several times to give the identification for where we were, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But they got back all right.
You mentioned the Indianapolis getting hit, so all these guys are evacuated onto your ship.
And yes.
Maybe it saved some of their lives with what happened to the Indianapolis, because,
yes,
I believe, if I remember correctly, there's about 800 of the 1,100 on board died when it sunk. But then,
right,
your ship gets hit again by,
yep,
kamikazes.
Right.
On the 12th of May, and you've got a photo of this that I'll put at hometownheroesradio.com, mm-hmm, of the explosion,
yes,
on your ship.
Yeah.
What did that feel like?
Well, that was another big blast. I was at my battle station, which was on the navigation bridge. I could see the plane coming. It was coming toward the starboard side of the ship, straight, low over the water. It was a twin engine. It had also been hit, but it came right in and hit the 20-millimeter and 40-millimeter guns mouth in that area on topside. It just practically wiped out our Marine detachment. Every battleship has a complement of about 75 Marines who handle those duties, the 20 and 40 millimeter guns mostly. We had about that time maybe 55 killed, something like that. The plane itself landed down in the bottom of one of our stacks with the pilot minus his head. Anyway, it created actually more damage that time than the time we were hit in Kwajalein, because it did a lot of damage down below, you know.
Well, and the bomb went off, and then that sets off gasoline, yeah. And you describe it here like a giant blowtorch.
Right.
You just see flame, flame shooting up into the sky.
Right, right.
And those who were killed, you mentioned 55 killed.
Yeah, right.
All those Marines on those guns, I mean, the purpose of those guns is to shoot down airplanes.
Right.
So they're probably firing at this bomber the whole time until it hits them and kills them.
Right.
That's the ugliness of war.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Did you ever get numb to that? The loss of life, the devastation, the chaos?
I guess I just took it as another day's work, you know.
How many times have we heard that from members of our greatest generation? Again, that was Bob Clark's shipmate, Grant Erickson. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. But when we come back, we're going to get back to Bob's story. He heard that kamikaze hit, but what did he have to do afterwards? And how long does he plan to keep playing his baritone in the Sounds of Freedom band? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton. With experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating one of America's newest centenarians. Bob Clark turned 100 this week in Clovis, California. But back in World War II, aboard the battleship USS New Mexico, there was no guarantee that he was going to live to see birthday number 24. When the battleship was struck by a Japanese kamikaze, killing the captain and 30 others and wounding three times that many, Bob was there helping to care for the casualties. Right, Bob?
Yes.
What did you have to do?
I just had to, are you working for me? Yeah. Well, get your little butt over here and let's pull this guy in, getting him in line for treatment.
Uh-huh.
That's how I kind of got lined up with the doctors.
So you're helping triage patients. Some of them are coming in on stretchers.
Yeah.
So you're seeing some of your shipmates pretty seriously wounded.
Yeah. We had a Marine detachment aboard ship.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking to various people around, getting information from other sources about how things are going and so on. I just took a stride. This is the way things are, you know.
So if I remember right, there were 30 of your shipmates were killed in that kamikaze attack, including your captain.
I think it was, I think 32.
That had to be hard to come to grips with, to understand.
It's the way things are.
Did you know any of those guys?
Some of those, a couple of those Marines were bandsmen, and they played in our band, our ship's band. It was an experience I'm glad I had. I'm glad I had it. And it didn't teach me much of anything because I was already in line with that kind of stuff. Some people think this is funny, but I was a Boy Scout. I was an Eagle Scout.
Nothing funny about that.
No.
After you guys were hit by that kamikaze, what happened afterwards in the days that followed?
Did our part of where we were. We had other targets to go after. Some of them were in where everybody was around, and, you know, or they were isolated.
That situation with the kamikaze, I mean, it kills all these shipmates of yours. It kills your captain. Is there any part of you after that that says, hey, that could have been me?
Oh, sure. You think of those times. You keep on doing what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. When you think back on that time, are you proud of your service?
Oh, well, yeah, sort of. It was there. Somebody had to do it. So you do it as best you can.
Well, thank you for doing it. Thank you for your service.
Well, you're welcome. It was an experience I'm glad I had.
How long are you going to keep playing with the Sounds of Freedom?
Until they kick me out.
I don't think that'll ever happen.
I don't know.
And tell me, if you can, real quick, this birthday party they had for you, your 100th birthday. You had a pretty big party with the band and family and all that. What was it like?
There's so many people, and, you know, it's hard to realize all these people that turned out.
A little overwhelming?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Tell me what you appreciate about this group, the Sounds of Freedom.
Oh, that they come to do their best. They're sold on being with this band. And that's it. They just try to do their best they can.
Do you have any advice for young musicians?
Get a side effect of some kind of involvement in your community. The community will look forward to what you can do, whether it's music or just being helpful or whatever.
And do you have a favorite piece of music that has the best baritone part?
Well, I have two kinds. I have a dance band type of thing. And I played in a dance band here in Fresno for 20 years. Lou Monte, for example, was the leader of the band that I was in. We played for various from Bakersfield to Merced.
Beautiful.
And then most of it, of course, was in the Fresno area. We were one of the eighth number one band of that nature, dance band. Mm-hmm. We played for parties, play for people dancing, and people seem to enjoy it.
What about with the Sounds of Freedom? What's your favorite thing to play?
Well, I would say one of the well-known pieces that made by a well-known composer.
Like a John Philip Sousa?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, old JP.
Well, is there anything I didn't ask you about that you'd like people to know?
For me, it was a way of meeting different kinds of people.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a baritone player older than you anywhere?
Well, I know there would be if they had survived. I don't know.
Well, there's my last question then. What's your secret to making it to 100 years old?
Be serious about your position, about the job that you get. Be serious with, if you're helping somebody, seriously help somebody. Whether it's a job or whether it's an illness, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And cooperate with everybody that's working for your betterment.
Like his fellow members of the Sounds of Freedom band, including the guy who just played that warm-up note that you heard on the baritone, Paul Hinckley, who picks Bob up and gives him a ride to every practice and every performance. Harry Paul is a flautist in the band. He served in the Army during the Korean War and has done as much as anybody to keep this volunteer group going.
I've known Bob probably about 28 years, pretty close to that. We played in the Swingin' Valley Vets at the VA hospital together. We went to Mount Rushmore, and he was a very comical person. We had little skits and stuff, and he always had one that was very funny. And he was just always a joker. He's just a really nice guy. You can't say enough about him. He's a marvelous person. And he always has a pleasant thing to say, even at his age. He can't hear very good. I can't hear very good either. So he's just a very wonderful person. I mean, he's just friendly. He's not outspoken, but a nice guy. Mm-hmm. You don't have many of those around.
Well, you don't have too many people in bands that are still playing an instrument at age 100 either. Have you guys ever had a centenarian in the band before?
A long time ago, there was a clarinet player when the band was still over at the 509 that was going to turn 100, but he retired from playing when he was 99, but that was the closest one. I'm only 13 or 14 years behind him, but I don't know if I'll ever make it. He's, of course, a veteran, a combat on the ship. He's a wonderful person. That's all I can say. Good friend to have. Always sent me a Christmas card, and just, I can't say any more.
So if you had to explain to somebody who's never heard the Sounds of Freedom what it is, what it's all about, who you guys are, what's your explanation?
We're a little different than everybody else. We try and push forward the honor of veterans and active duty people and try and promote music that would help them remember the veterans.
And who are you guys?
Well, we're not really all veterans. There's very few veterans in the band, but they all appreciate veterans, and that's why they're here volunteering their time. We do very good.
Bob's your oldest at 100. What do you think your youngest is?
Well, we used to have one that was 12 years old, but they've gotten older. The drummer is now, I remember when he came, I think he was 10 or 12. Now he's in college. And we had a piccolo player that joined us when she was 12. She's a senior at USC. We've had a lot of great musicians play with us. We've had music teachers. We've had teachers and dentists and doctors and everybody that come and play with us, and even my son's played with us at one time. We've given several concerts to raise money for veterans.
And make sure to mark your calendar, because the next time you can catch the Sounds of Freedom and 100-year-old euphonium extraordinaire Bob Clark in concert will be March 13th, a free concert that's going to begin at 2 p.m. at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District in Clovis, California. And let's give you one last taste of the band today. Here is how they sounded playing Happy 100th Birthday to Bob at their rehearsal this week.
Thank you.
happy 100th birthday, and many, many more. For photos of Bob Clark then and now, you can head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll see some of the commendations and certificates he received from elected officials, from his congressman to the governor to senators, his mayor, supervisors, you name it, and a beautiful birthday cake with a photo of his ship and his beloved baritone right on top of that cake. So check that out, and check us out next week. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again then, when we'll be reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma, because you can check out their Wall of Honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there, and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that Wall of Honor.